Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The start of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine marks the end of the post-Cold War era. Europe's security architecture was not only designed to exclude Russia, but to be against Russia. In short, NATO failed to keep the peace. Now we're left to live with the consequences. Crosstalking the post-Cold War order, I'm joined by my guest, Bruce Marks, in Philadelphia. He's a former Pennsylvania state senator and attorney for Donald Trump's 2016 and 2020 campaigns. In Providence, we have Vladimir Goldstein. He is the chair of the Department of Slavic Studies at Brown University. And in Brussels, we cross to Pierre Emmanuel Tellman. He is a lecturer at Lyon University. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Vladimir, let me go to you first here. Going back to my introduction, unfortunately, the events that we're seeing unfold for the past 3 weeks could have been very predictable because the security order in Europe excluded Russia, and we know now it was against Russia. This is something that should have been avoided, but I, on this program, and many, many guests, saw a collision coming. Maybe not to this magnitude, but we saw it coming. And it is an unfortunate set of events that could have been avoided. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you, but somehow I believe that was definitely in NATO interest to provoke Russia, to kind of ostracize Russia, to demonize Russia. And, you know, reasons that seem to be obvious. A, you know, once Russia is out, demonized, the rest of the, you know, NATO gets together, you know, much cementing their unity, their friendship. This is one thing. Then we have a situation in Ukraine, which serves as a wedge for European-Chinese integration. With this wedge, you know, China is kept away from this One Belt Road initiative. Russia is kept away, and United States continues to be in. So that's kind of, I think it's a reasonable policy from United States point of view, but it's also kind of from the, you know, in large perspective, it works against the world, which still moves toward each other, toward cooperation, toward working together.
Bruce, your thoughts on this and the same question here, because it was the security order in Europe that collapsed. I mean, NATO was supposed to keep the peace. They were about projecting stability. And what happened was is that the trying to bring Ukraine into the alliance was antithetical to that mission. Go ahead, Bruce.
I don't think that NATO did anything wrong at all. I think that we're ignoring the history of what's happened in Europe. Russia is an aggressor country. There was no reason that Russia had to invade Ukraine in 2014. There was no reason that Russia had to invade Ukraine in 2012. Vladimir Putin lied about what happened in 2014 with his little green men in Crimea, and he lied in 2022 saying that he wouldn't invade Ukraine. We live in a civilized world. Europe should be a civilized country. We should be encouraging democracies. Ukraine was a democratic country. Russia is not. Russia has assisted in...
Bruce, since you bring up democracy, what about the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Ukraine in 2014? They already had a democratic government. Why did the West overthrow it?
Well, the West didn't overthrow it.
Yes, it did. There's ample evidence that that is the case. I'm sure you've come across the name Victoria Nuland. Are you familiar with her name?
Listen, I'm familiar with Victoria Nuland. I'm also familiar with conversations that then Vice President Biden had with it was afterwards with Poroshenko. But the fact of the matter is that there were 100,000 or more Ukrainians who occupied Kiev and overthrew the and supported removing the corrupt Yushchenko government.
Illegally.
And after that, then they had Democrat elections, and Ukraine hasn't put opposition leaders in prison like Russia has done with Navalny.
That is not true. You have a major Ukrainian political figure that is under house arrest. His name is Medvedchuk. Okay, so I mean that's not true. Let me go. I'm interested in your line of thought, but I have to get my third guest into the program, Pierre Emmanuel. I'll go back to you, Bruce. I want everybody in first. Okay.
I think you're terrific. Absolutely, Peter. You're great.
I'm trying to be fair to everybody, okay? Pierre-Emmanuel, what are your thoughts on what's happened here? Because you're a European. It seems to me this works very much against Europe's interests here. And on top of it, it seems very hypocritical to continue to talk about supporting Ukraine, but actually not really doing anything for Ukraine. Ukraine got stuck in this wedge, and I blame NATO for that. Go ahead in Brussels.
Yes, unfortunately, European Union territory and its geographical surroundings became a theater of rivalry between the United States and Russia. And this problem goes back to the fall of USSR. At that time, you know, there was some ideas to reintegrate Russia in a sort of new concept of nations at European level and in the world, but it has not been made that way because NATO and EU constantly took advantage of the weakness of Russia at that time to enlarge their own zone of influence, NATO and EU together, until they reach Russia's borders and the security zone. And unfortunately, Europeans didn't try to have a better balance between Euro-Atlantic space and Euro-Asian space with Russia, and to be a sort of moderator and to have a balance between these two poles of power. And instead, they gradually more and more contradictory to the goal ideas of Europe from Atlantic to Ural, they aligned themselves and the United States objectives on their main Atlantis allies to always expand this Euro-Atlantic zone, and Russia was feeling more and more cornered. And regarding the latest crisis today in Ukraine with this conflict, actually, the United States made everything but a huge campaign of disinformation to avoid any substantial negotiation on a new European security treaty, and it ended up in this clash. And Russia was feeling obliged to, for securing its margin of maneuver or interest, to intervene, especially to protect Donbass republics who were under threat of constant military threat
Pierre-Emmanuel, I'm really glad you brought that up. Let me go to Vladimir about that. You know, there's obviously a lot of coverage of what's going on in Ukraine, as it should be here, but there was scant coverage for 8 years of what was happening in the Donbass, the constant shelling, the killing of civilians. Over 14,000 people are dead because of that. That got no coverage whatsoever in Western media. And that is front and center of what Russia was looking at. The Russians believe, they've showed some documentation that needs to be verified, that there was going to be an imminent attack on the Donbass. What was all of that military hardware going into Ukraine for? Okay, and I referenced the Washington Post. Okay, they wrote that up last week. Massive amounts towards what end? Go ahead, Vladimir.
Yeah, I think you know we're dealing with what they call manufactured, consent or content. That is, you know, there are certain things which the Western media covers, certain things they don't cover. To take Pierre-Emmanuel's point, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, somebody calculated Russia withdrew from the territory size of 700,000 square miles. This is a giant size. They withdrew. So continue on talking about some kind of authoritarian regime or some kind of, you know, Soviet regime banned on expansion, it's just blatantly false. The same thing applies to the situation here. We see bombed houses in Kiev or, you know, in Kharkov, but we haven't seen, you know, bombed houses day in, day out on TV For the last 8 years. So this is just, it's clear, it's orchestrated campaign that no matter what Russia does, it's always wrong and it's blamed. And okay, no country is ideal. Russia has its serious faults, United States have serious faults, France has serious faults, but they have to discuss openly. And when every country recognizes that they are not, pure like a Snow White, then they can sit down and negotiate. And that was the main principles which, kept Europeans going. The Westphalian War Treaty, where every country do not interfere into other affairs. They don't bring the issues of Navalny or something. This is kind of ridiculous. We can find endless amount from Assange to anyone here. So why bring that up? Countries have to pursue their own ways, whatever they think, and deal with each other in peaceful way. But, we don't hear that. We hear bad Russia, demonize Russia, Russia bombs this. But what the West done doing, expansion of NATO, supplying lethal weapons, bombing children for 8 years, we don't hear that. This is kind of, so what kind of a dialogue can we have when we have conditions like that?
And let me go to Bruce now before we go to the break. A lot's been said here. Bruce, please react.
I mean, as far as Pierre Emmanuel is concerned, I mean, that just ignores history. The Russia left areas in Europe, which it had attempted to dominate under the Soviet Union, and the people those countries became members of NATO and members of the EU because they wanted freedom and democracy. That's why Poland, that's why Bulgaria, that's why Romania, that's why Hungary, that's why the Czech Republic, that's why they're members of the EU. They didn't want to continue to be controlled by Russia. Look at those countries compared to Belarus. Where would you rather live? In a free Poland or Belarus under under a dictator? And the reason that the weapons were coming into Ukraine wasn't to attack the Donbass and Lugansk. There were no invasions there. There were no aircraft that were bombing the cities there in the last 8 years. Those weapons came in the last year. Let's not forget, it was only under President Trump that we authorized these type of weapons because of the risk of an invasion by Russia. And Putin said he wasn't going to invade, but thank goodness at least some of those weapons came in, and they're being used to defend Ukraine. So it's hardly surprising.
Well, but Bruce, those weapons are going to some very nefarious groups, and we'll talk about that. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the post-Cold War order. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the post-Cold War era. All right, gentlemen, I want to read a quote to you from George H.W. Bush on August 1st, 1991, in Kiev, in the parliament, actually. This is what he had to say. U.S. would not support those who seek independence in order to replace a far-off tyranny with a local despotism. They will not aid those who promote a suicidal nationalism based on ethnic hatred. Let me go to Pierre Emmanuel. I said at the very end of the first part of the program here about some nefarious groups. Well, there are a lot of nefarious groups in Ukraine, and they have been integrated into the Ukrainian army. I'm talking about neo-Nazis, fascists, that have been recognized by the European Union, well-known in the United States and Canada as well, and they were getting some of these arms as well, if not a lot of them. We don't really know, but certainly they did. And so I think that George Bush Sr., was very prophetic here, because what the U.S. has promoted after the coup in 2014 was ethnic nationalism. Go ahead, in Brussels.
There is a huge denial among European Union, different governments, and also European Commission, European Parliament, of this aspect. Although there are many articles from academics and also journalists who wrote about this dangerous aspect of using extreme right extremists in Ukraine. But unfortunately, because of the narrative of European Union that in 2004 in Maidan there was a peaceful and democratic revolution, they totally deny the reality And the reality was that there were trained extremist groups with deeper connections with neo-Nazi ideologies who did the coup d'etat. It's not peaceful students who could occupy the parliament and attacked the bearcats, the police, and they were used as a force to push for this regime change. And afterwards, these people were integrated in the Ukrainian forces. And if you remember, when Mr. Poroshenko was elected in Ukraine as a president after the coup d'etat, of course, without the votes of Crimea and Donbass already, who didn't want to accept this regime change, this Ukrainian army, instead of the promise of Mr. Poroshenko to negotiate with the independent republics in the east, in Donbass, and to have a different status, maybe a federalization of Ukraine, he launched a military offensive. And with this battalion, with this neo-Nazi extreme rights militants integrated in the army, and they made a lot of damage on civilians. And this is why in the Donbass republics, they don't want anymore to be part of Ukraine. And recently, they asked for assistance
Russia. Pierre Emmanuel, all that culminated in the Minsk I and Minsk II accords, which Ukraine never implemented. That's a big question. What if they had done that? And we might have had a very different history. Vladimir, talk about these groups here, because I'm a consumer of cable news in the United States. This is never mentioned at all. And it's very well known. It's very well documented, but it's never talked about. Go ahead, Vladimir.
What we have to be aware of is that Ukraine is deeply divided society. And, you know, it was moving in the right direction. Everything was kind of slowly, like many other post-Soviet countries. But part of the Eastern Ukraine, before this Maidan and everything, they were going along. But then after Maidan Revolution, everything Russian-speaking, Russian began to be suppressed. And there's very serious studies based on polls by Columbia University, by other universities, when they ask, you know, people's opinion. And ever since 2014, more and more people, up to 70%, 80% of Eastern Ukraine do not want to be part of Kyiv. This is objective data. This is not made by someone. So this is their concrete terms. And the more they want to sort of break away, the more pressure Kyiv was putting on them, bombing them, calling them names, not treating them seriously, and it became kind of absolutely kind of widening gyre, and you know that's where we are. So instead of solving it, instead of trying to realize that we, Ukraine, are in the center of Europe, we have to work as a bridge, we have to be, you know, as some kind of united force, they began to became a spearhead of NATO, or United States, or the wedging policy, and that's what we have. Now the wedge came right to the heart of Ukraine, and that's what they have to deal with, rather than facing that they are dealing with multi-ethnic, multicultural kind of unit there, where every language, every culture should be respected. And we should go back to history of Ukraine. For, you know, this is very recent. You know, all their kind of people whom they recognize as leaders, Bandera and everything, they're heroes. They were, once they came to power under Nazis, they began to eliminate Jews. They began to eliminate Poles. They began to eliminate everything. They were trying to build the country on the Nazi kind of model, Ukraine for Ukrainians. And that this, some groups of it are still exerted tremendous power there, ideologically, as we can see, and so on. So this is a society where part of the society do not want to belong to this entity. And this is kind of a reality which the West, for some reason, does want to face.
You know, Bruce, in Philadelphia, the war continues. There are conflicting reports, and I'm being very generous there, of what's going on. Should the United States and NATO continue to pour in arms in Ukraine? Will that help Ukraine in its fate? Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, I think that we should continue to support Ukraine in defending itself from the Russian invasion, which is now a full-scale war in Ukraine. That's what the United States did in supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. There are those who will argue that at the end of the day, we couldn't turn into a democratic country, which we didn't. But I think the United States should be supporting Ukraine and defending itself from the invasion.
Bruce,
I
also do you support a no-fly zone?
I do. I support, and I think you're going to see a very substantial portion of the politicians in the United States.
Bruce, I have a question for you, and this is a legitimate question, factual question. The Ukrainians don't want to fly their own planes. They've grounded them, but they want planes from NATO. Why?
Well, number one, they're having difficulty putting their planes in the air because of you have Russian military
Russia
superiority.
Russia will shoot down these NATO planes, too, if they're in Ukrainian airspace.
Well, they're going to be, they may shoot them down. There are, obviously, they're killing, you know, Ukrainians, especially civilians, you know, every day, bombing hospitals, things like that. But the planes are going to be flown by Ukrainians. They're not going to be flown by
But they'll be shot out of the sky. I don't understand the logic. They won't fly their own planes because they'll be shot out of the sky, but they're flying someone else's and they won't be shot out of the sky?
Listen, the Ukrainians are very brave people. Zelensky's a very brave president. They're putting their lives on the line.
But they have no control of the airspace at all. No, zero. Well,
that's because they're fighting the Russian Federation.
Yeah, so you want to widen the war. You think NATO should go to war with Russia?
I don't want to widen the war at all. I think that Putin should order his forces to turn around and to go back to Belarus or go back to Russia or wherever they came in from the invasion. I don't believe that there's any justification at all that there are Russian tanks with Zs on them, you know, 10 miles from the center of Kiev. But I do want to comment on one thing. You know, a lot of countries have neo-Nazis, very, very small numbers. We have a far right in the United States. Obviously, I'm familiar with the Azov Battalion.
Do they have high government officials in the United positions in the United States?
The neo-Nazis?
Yeah.
Not that I'm familiar with.
But do in Ukraine.
Well, I'm not familiar with anybody who would be considered to be a neo-Nazi.
Who
is in a significant
Have you ever heard of the name Porubi or Yarosh? Do you know those names? Well, they're neo-Nazis, and they have quite a bit of influence in Ukraine.
They may have influence. I don't believe that they're in the government.
You're proving my point, Bruce. I mean, it's a one-sided narrative. It's complicated, just as Vladimir has explained to us. It's a very complicated country, but it's turned into a cartoon in Western media.
Well, hold on. I don't think it's complicated. When President Putin says he wants to go into Ukraine to denazify it, and the president of Ukraine is a Jew, and the prime minister of Ukraine
Zelensky is afraid of these people as well, okay? He's terrified of these people as well.
I don't think Zelensky's terrified of anybody, because even though the United States offered to help him leave Kiev to go to Lviv, he said, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition.
Well, but, Bruce, you're changing the topic here. It's a one-sided narrative about what's going on there. I'm heartbroken to see Russians and Ukrainians kill each other. I'm heartbroken by that. And I'll add to it is that for all the people on cable TV talking about Ukraine, probably very few of them have ever been there. I've been there over and over and over again. Okay, it's terrible to see the United States back this ideology that we thought was exterminated from Europe in the mid-20th century, and it's back in Ukraine, and no one wants to talk about it.
I'm happy to talk about it, and I've been there quite a bit.
All right, I want to be fair to everyone time-wise. Pierre-Emmanuel, 1 minute, finish up the program for us.
Yes, so about this thematic of neo-Nazi?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, there is another element when you don't take into account is that in Canada and United States, there is also a lobby of Ukrainians. And these Ukrainians, American Ukrainians, came from USSR, and they fled USSR in the 50s, on the 40s, because of the war, when USSR liberated Ukraine from the Nazi. And some Ukrainians, Bandera and all these militants for to have a new Ukrainian nation supported by Nazi Germany, when the USSR liberated the country, won the war, they had to flee to United States and Canada. And these people are very aggressive and lobby hard in United States and Canada. And this is also why, United States and Canada have the worst and the most pressing position against Russia using these people. There are also records from CIA files.
Let me finish it this way. I quoted George Bush Sr. He was a former head of the CIA. When he talked about this ethnic nationalism, I think he's talking about exactly what we've been talking about in this program, these types of people and ideas. Context is important, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Philadelphia, Providence, and in Brussels. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.